I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to celebrate a milestone. The Indianapolis Symphonic Choir turns 80 and is partnering with the Indianapolis Public Schools for Music in Our Schools to mark the occasion. We'll talk about the state of music education and the choir's distinguished history. My guests are Teron Cooper, an IPS music teacher, Drew Black, Central Indiana Community Foundation Senior Community Investment Officer, and Michael Petrie, Executive Director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. Please join the conversation. Call 866-476-3881, email nolimits at WFYI.org, Facebook is No Limits WFYI, Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news. Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. And if you're thinking that we have changed the theme song for today, you are right. That is music courtesy of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. We're here celebrating the Symphonic Choir's 80th anniversary and Music in Our Schools Month. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Teron Cooper. He is an Indianapolis Public Schools music teacher. Drew Black. He is with the Central Indiana Community Foundation. And Michael Petrie, executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. So, Michael, I'm going to start with you. Welcome to all of you, by the way. It's good to have you
here.
Glad to be here. And a joyous and musical occasion. Tell me a little bit about what the 80th anniversary of the Symphonic Choir means for the organization.
That's a great question. So, you're exactly right. The Symphonic Choir marks its 80th anniversary season. But so what, right? What's the context of that? The Symphonic Choir is made up of about 200 all-volunteer singers who re-audition every year to be a part of this and collectively contribute just around 40,000 volunteer hours every year. It's a huge commitment, suffice it to say. There's usually most larger cities or even mid-sized cities have a symphonic chorus, that is to say, a large chorus that predominantly performs repertoire that's accompanied by a large orchestra. What makes this 80th special is that we're among the oldest, believe it or not, in the United States. Certainly the large cities on the East Coast predate us by a couple of them by a century, in fact. But in terms of in the Midwest and certainly anything west of the Mississippi, the Symphonic Choir is a sage symphonic choir in terms of age. This also shows, I think, a little bit of maturity and service in the community for the Symphonic Choir, that we have many generations of singers, many generations of audiences that have come to know the Symphonic Choir over these eight decades as well.
Take me back to the, because as I as I do my math on this, the Symphonic Choir then had to have been established in the Great Depression.
1937.
Which would not have been the most auspicious times, particularly in the Farm Belt, for great endeavors. So what prompted the establishment?
Why in the world would they have done that, right?
Well, I'm just curious because when something like that, those stories are always inspiring.
Yeah. The symphony, so the ISO here in town, predates the Symphonic Choir by just under a decade. And there's a number of pieces of repertoire that, quite frankly, you need a choir in order to perform things like Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with the Joyful, Joyful We Adore Thee that a lot of people know, or Carmina Burana, that raucous piece that today is pretty standard in repertoire, but was written in 37, actually, the same year we were founded. And so the symphony came to, at that time, Elmer Steffen, who was the director of music for the Catholic Diocese of Indianapolis, and said, we'd like you to go ahead and establish a choir so that this repertoire can be performed locally. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it. But when you get to kind of the more emotional story, I think, the founding of the Symphonic Choir, people gather to sing at milestones, birthdays, sporting events, celebrations, also at times of trial.
And funerals.
Yeah, funerals and times of loss. And the country, the United States, was going through a lot in 37 in a lot of different ways, not just economically, but certainly around the world. There was a lot of tension and things were getting close to the boiling point. And I don't think it's a coincidence that people turned to choral music at that instance as a way of connectivity and artistic outlet.
Drew, what's the importance of the symphonic choir in sort of the cultural landscape of Indianapolis and central Indiana?
Well, they're incredibly important to us. The symphonic choir has been one of our grantee organizations for a long time. I've been at the Community Foundation for 5 years and have maintained as our community investment officer that's responsible for arts and cultural grant making. And with the symphonic choir, I mean, there's no one quite like them. We invest in sound leadership. We really appreciate the work that Michael does. They leverage partnerships incredibly well. Their programming is wonderful. I've had the opportunity to sit on a couple of concerts with Michael and have really enjoyed the work. And they just add to the overall cultural fabric of the city. My boss, Brian Payne, is always one to really talk about how to make Indianapolis what he calls a top 10 city of choice. We really need to focus on providing access to art, nature, and beauty to everyone every day. And the symphonic choir provides such an incredible opportunity for all of us to enjoy their service that, you know, we really feel strongly about the work that they're doing here in the community.
Teron, how important is the symphonic choir to the music community here in the city?
It's huge. As a music teacher, I'm a Michigan native, and when I moved down to Indianapolis as a teacher in the classroom, you give so much to students that you forget a little bit about yourself. And I realized that there was something missing, and I wasn't performing anymore, and my kids were getting that experience, but I wasn't getting that experience. And so having the symphonic choir here was great, because not only did I get to attend the concerts, but I'm a member right now. And in the classroom, the symphonic choir always gives back. I've had their soloists, I've had Michael Petrie and Eric Stark come into my classroom, work with my students, and it's always been a phenomenal experience that the kids can get to see that type of caliber of music performed and get inspired by that. And when it's not always feasible to take an entire group of kids, maybe down to the ISO or someplace, to have that ability to have that in my classroom is absolutely fantastic.
How important, and I'm going to frame this question with a little bit of backdrop. In 1937, when the symphonic choir was established, you know, many of the high schools that we still use in Indianapolis were in existence then. And, you know, the stages, the auditoriums that they had were like cathedrals at that time, because the arts were considered a really integral part of any education. That notion has been under some assault in recent years. So I'm going to start, Teron, with you. You know, given that we have to make a case now for arts education, how important are these kinds of, I'm moving us toward talking about music in our schools, how important are these kinds of public-private or even government for-profit, not-for-profit partnerships to developing students, and why is music important to them?
They're huge. Without the organizations, then you don't have arts in the city. And if you don't have arts in the city, then there's not opportunities for the kids to take advantage of. Because the reality of the situation is, if kids have to travel outside of the city to get those situations, they're not going to. I work at Shortridge High School, and when we take our kids going hiking, a lot of them have never been outside of the city. They don't even know what a silo is at times. And if they don't know that, then they're definitely not going to go out to see opera, to see the arts, unless it's critically a portion of the city that they're a part of. And when my kids are going downtown and taking the bus to the mall and they see the arts and we have those type of fundings for those programs, that's where we need to start.
Drew, same question.
Yeah, I mean, based on what Terrence said, you know, clearly finances are an issue at the school level for the most part. But the arts are so important that it requires kind of an all hands on deck approach to ensure that all students have access to high quality arts opportunities. We are really interested in the transformative impact that the arts have on kids, especially those of low socioeconomic backgrounds. It's been determined through lots of research that students that have access to high quality arts education, to high quality music education, not only are they receiving powerful programming in an area that enriches their lives, but we're seeing outcomes that are indicative of better academic growth rates, better standardized test scores, better attendance in schools, lifelong indicators of success like greater civic engagement, greater satisfaction in career. And so it is so important that all of these kids have access to these programs. And we know that our districts, as hard as they're trying, can't possibly provide kind of the wraparound arts service necessary to really push that needle. And so it's organizations like the Symphonic Choir, like the Metropolitan Youth Orchestra, like Indianapolis Children's Choir that can come in and add value to your existing programming, and layer that, provide you that additional support to really help kids have that access to robust music education programming.
Michael.
You know, it also has to be a little bit of that ripple effect theory. Mm-hmm. Arts organizations themselves are struggling to find enough funding, right, and build audiences, and some even say maintain or build relevancy. But the ripple effect rings true. Yes, we have small staffs at arts organizations or smaller budgets than we wish we had. But we can go in and work with, for example, music educators. We don't have to be in the classroom working with every student, but we can work with the teachers and equip those teachers to be more effective, to be more inspired, or to be more inspiring, to help to fight burnout. Because, Taryn, you can tell us about this. It feels like a constant uphill battle, doesn't it? But these arts organizations can equip others to be effective leaders. We can also equip the leaders of the schools, school boards, to be more informed about the value of the arts in education. So general advocacy through that ripple effect, which I think is really important with a scarcity that we have for art support in general.
Absolutely.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir's 80th anniversary and Music in Our Schools Month here on No Limits. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. So, Michael, talk me through how we are going to mark the 80th here. What events do we have scheduled that will...
Well, I hope that anybody who's listening is buckled up if they're driving. But even if you're sitting stationary in your office, you may want to buckle up at this. This 80th season, we're at the two-thirds mark right now, let's say, has been full of milestones for the choir. First, we went to Carnegie Hall for the first time in just about 40 years and performed there. And Taryn, incredible, right?
Yeah, it was absolutely amazing.
Nothing like walking out on the stage at Carnegie Hall. Mm-hmm. We also signed an international recording contract with Naxos, the largest classical music label, and released a piece that was actually debuted and commissioned right here in the community. We were on PBS, local FYI, for a TV broadcast. And then certainly music education is a big part. And the All City Honor Choir, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit today with IPS, is a special, I think, a really meaningful opportunity that we'll celebrate during the 80th.
Are there upcoming events, too, that people can...
That's right. Actually, this Friday we're performing Mendelssohn's Elijah at the Palladium, so it's Friday at 8 o'clock. And it's a piece that speaks to the humanity, really, in all of us, and struggle and confusion and looking for guidance. But it's a beautiful piece of music. Taryn has sung that before.
Taryn, tell me about the piece.
The piece itself, it's pretty fantastic. I have to say that I appreciate the Symphonic Choir because having the opportunity to perform all these wonderful works. And even though I'm not singing Elijah with this mm-hmm. concert, my experiences with it at Second Presbyterian Church and whatnot has been absolutely phenomenal. If there's a piece that you want to go to see that's kind of that mark where you're listening for, I would say Elijah is that piece. From the kind of like female choruses to the like children's choir type parts that are sung to Elijah himself, it's definitely a real treat. And my first experience with it was last year. So I would definitely recommend, if you've never heard it live, this would be the time to go see it.
We are talking about the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir's 80th anniversary and Music in Our Schools Month. My guests are Taryn Cooper, IPS music teacher, Drew Black with Central Indiana Community Foundation, and Michael Petrie with the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. If you want to join the conversation, you can call us at 866-476-3881. For now, please just listen to this beautiful music. I'm John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. That is not our usual theme music. That is absolutely gorgeous music from the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. We're talking about the choir today on No Limits because it is the choir's 80th anniversary. We're also going to be talking about Music in Our Schools Month. My guests are Taryn Cooper, who is an IPS music teacher, Drew Black, who's with the Central Indiana Community Foundation, and Michael Petrie, executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So we've talked about the role that the Symphonic Choir plays in our community now. How has it evolved over time from the way it started in 1937 to what it is now?
Wow. I wasn't around then. I'll promise that. But interestingly,
that's why people write things
down. Exactly, that's right.
We remember them.
About a year ago, the library here in town, Indianapolis Library, archived all of our board minutes and documents, concert programs, recordings from the past, at that point, 79 years or so. And that afforded all of us on the staff and many of our board members the opportunity to pause and take some time to look back through that history as we were approaching this milestone. And consequently, that's all available online now through the library's website for anybody to enjoy thumbing through. To answer your question, the choir started as more of a singing society. No staff. And all of the choruses, performances were with the Indianapolis Symphony Orchestra. And then about 25 years ago or so, 25 years previous to now, the choir started to produce its own concerts outside of just those performances with the ISO. And then about 5 years into that, recognized the need to be more intentional about the role in the community that is providing opportunities in the schools, opportunities for lifelong learning, not just for young students, K-12 students, but for adults as well. And then, of course, with that need for added programming comes the need for some staff to solicit funds for those programs and then to, of course, administer and evaluate and implement those programs. So it's really only in the past 25 years or so that the Symphonic Choir has had this what I would say is a semi-robust structure, staffing structure for an arts organization. Prior to that, it was a group of incredibly dedicated and talented singers that were primarily focused on singing.
Drew, do you think it would be possible in this time when we say arts budgets are often on the block let's face it, many of the civic engagement, community engagement indices indicate that people aren't as connected as they were a couple, three generations ago. Would it be possible to launch something like the Symphonic Choir? Because it is large and it required a happy chain of circumstance, obviously, mm-hmm. to get the thing off the ground in the first place.
Mm-hmm. Well, I definitely think that the public appetite is there for something like that. I think we continue to hear more and more about the value that arts education has on kind of your standard classic education. I think, you know, the political will, that would be a question. But, I definitely think that this community is blessed with a great number of assets when it comes to nonprofit partners that are in the space, when it comes to committed, you know, school districts that are interested in improving, you know, outcomes for all students. And when it comes to the philanthropic sector, I think, you know, we definitely have some of the key tenements that would help make that possible. Currently, the city actually competed for a national opportunity with the Kennedy Center for the Arts out of Washington, D.C., called the Any Given Child Initiative, which seeks mm-hmm. to do essentially...
We've done shows on Any Given Child.
Right.
So yeah.
To do just that. And that's moving forward. I mean, you know, essentially the construct or the background was that Indianapolis competed nationally to become an Any Given Child city, which essentially takes a partner school district and commits resources, technical assistance necessary to ensure that any given child in any classroom in any school in that district, grades K through 8, will have access to high-quality music, dance, theater education, and visual and 2D arts. And that continues to move forward in the city, and that's been, I think, you know, a great illustration of what we can do. We're not there yet, but we've had 30 community-based organizations that have been stakeholders in this. We've had the Arts Council spearheading the initiative and their wonderful staff, and then a committed partner in Indianapolis Public Schools. And so, you know, that is a community-wide initiative that we're seeing really starting to take off.
Taryn, you're on the front lines with all of this. Does it ever feel like you're swimming upstream on this? Yeah, I'm just going to ask. Yeah.
Yeah, it really does. Sometimes performing arts teachers are considered those in the trenches. Mm-hmm. And you're kind of putting a ship together as you're sailing down. Mm-hmm. And the ship hasn't really been put together, but you're mm-hmm. just piecing it together as you're going. And, yeah, I mean, today alone, I work at an international baccalaureate school. Mm-hmm. So we're submitting grades to the international baccalaureate. We're submitting our term grades for the end of this term. At the same time, we have a... parent-teacher conferences this evening, and we open our musical tomorrow. So when you put all those together, it kind of seems a little daunting.
We've gotten an email from a listener named Richard, and if you want to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Richard asks, why isn't the choir part of ISO like in other cities? Michael.
Richard's very well informed. That's exactly right. That's right. The Symphonic Choir here is a separate 501c3. Similar to, let's say, Cincinnati's model mm-hmm. is independent. The three main choruses in D.C., Washington, D.C., are also independent. But, of course, Cleveland, the chorus is part of the orchestra there, as is Chicago, Atlanta, many others. That's a great question. I wasn't around, mm-hmm. as I said, 8 decades ago. But the documents that we have from our founding, the minutes, say that at the request of the symphony to perform a specific piece of music by Kodai, a piece that I don't know that we've performed since then, a group was amassed to start the symphonic choir. So that's the best that we know at this point.
What are the advantages to being separate?
That's a great
question. Each side, yeah.
So,
disadvantages, too.
You know, you can see both sides of the argument, certainly, but we really see the opportunity because our focus is choral music. Mm-hmm. That ensures that we program repertoire that even the best symphony, which we have an incredible symphony here in Indianapolis, no doubt, is less likely to be committed to performing. Their focus is orchestral repertoire. That would mean that they're probably not going to perform the Rachmaninoff Vespers. Great piece of music, mm-hmm. a full concert of music, but there's no orchestra. Or perhaps the Bach Mass in B minor. It's perhaps one of Bach's greatest works that he ever wrote, but it's a decidedly choral work, and it uses comparatively a smaller orchestra. It's a Baroque piece. Mm-hmm. So it would not use the full orchestra complements that, say, a Mahler symphony would use. So it ensures, by having our independence as the symphonic choir, that choral repertoire, decidedly choral music, gets its place in the community, I think, with a little more intentionality.
Mm-hmm. How do you go about choosing the repertoire, the songs that you're going, the pieces of music that you're going to perform?
For starters, our artistic director, Eric Stark, this is his 15th season with the choir, he tends to plan 3 to 4 years out. Also recognizing, though, that sometimes an arts organization needs to be able to respond fairly quickly, depending on what's going on in the community or in the world, reacting to something that's in everybody's hearts or minds. But as I said,
nothing like that going on
right now. Exactly.
Yeah.
And to that point, we can also, the arts certainly set the forum for discussion, but don't always provide the answer. So even with Elijah, that's been planned for multiple years, I think people will glean this opportunity to perhaps have a dialogue on any given topic. Eric selects the music, thinking about what has not been performed lately, thinking also about what has been performed lately and was really well received, but perhaps we should approach it again with a fresh perspective, a fresh voice, so to speak. He also really is interested in programming new repertoire, that is, commissioning new works to be written. Beethoven's Ninth Symphony was new at one point, of course, and he believes that we should be adding new high-quality music to the canon of classical music that exists today.
We're talking about the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir's 80th anniversary and Music in Our Schools Month here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. Taryn, what makes for a good musical learning experience for a student? Because I'm hearing the process here of selecting these pieces. Is it difficulty? And I don't mean to demean the three of you, but when we talk about the importance of the arts to the community, often it can boil down to a kind of eat your vegetables argument here. Or do you look for pieces that you think, God, they're just going to have fun doing this?
Yeah, you have to take – it depends on where you are and the school and the experience of the kids. The kids have to have fun. That's the bottom line. And if they're having fun, then you kind of sneak the learning in a little bit at the side. And you have to choose music that the kids will be successful with doing. So you have to know going in, what is the kid's background? Where can they read music? Do you have to teach it by rote? And then from there, you choose something that they can do immediately to be successful. And once they have that first success, then you can kind of sneak everything else in and they don't mind it. And it seems that most of my teaching jobs, I've always been starting music programs, and that's kind of where I've started. And I'm just now starting to see some of that work kind of pay off with the kids, and they grow into their interests. And that's really, really exciting to see.
Is that the argument, Drew, ultimately, for investing in arts and music education here in the community? Because at some point, you would sort of hope that the philanthropy could step back because there's just much more organic community support for music and the arts.
Yeah, no, I think it's a complicated argument because the arts are beautiful and they stand alone in terms of enriching our lives, essentially providing us with the cultural lifeblood of a community. But when it comes to investment, either it, being from the school side or the philanthropic side or the corporate side, there has to essentially be a return on it. And so, you know, I think what Taryn's speaking to is this arts integrated instruction where we're almost tricking students into learning. That has
against
proven
their
to be
will. Yeah.
against
yeah.
their will, right? Yeah. It takes a medium that
I'm
they
familiar
can,
with the dynamic. Don't
yeah,
worry.
Of course. But it takes something that's interest based, that provides the opportunity to self express, and then it creates a learning opportunity out of that. And as I had referenced earlier, you know, we're seeing a lot of data that suggests that this really pays off, and it's important. You know, if obviously, music education and the arts are really important to all communities, but to this community especially. I think, if we can really push the needles on academic outcomes for kids, on social emotional development outcomes for kids through arts integrated education, then we're really doing the community a service, because essentially with the arts, if we're catalyzing learning, we're creating more well-rounded individuals. We're creating individuals that are more engaged in school, that are, essentially have better chances to achieve at high levels academically. That in turn, essentially prepare our future workforce and, create a stronger local economy. And so, yes, I think that a lot of us see this as, something that maybe the narrative needs to shift a little bit, so we're wearing that out front more often. But music education, arts education is incredibly valuable, and the return on investment is enormous. So I think that's something that we need to start addressing.
Yeah,
Michael.
Yeah, that really, what you said resonates, I think, obviously, with all of us. As much as we may want to see somebody grow up to become a professional singer or a professional oboe player, mm-hmm. that's really not the goal mm-hmm. right. of K-12 arts education, mm-hmm. is it, per se, or to become a visual artist, whatever the medium may be. We're teaching these kids about innovation, mm-hmm. which is a hot word that we all talk about in Indiana, and we mm-hmm. want an innovative workforce. Or these soft skills that we talk mm-hmm. about, communication, project management, problem solving, the things that make somebody an effective employee
right.
beyond mm-hmm. just knowing how to do X, Y, Z task. This is exactly what somebody learns through being in theater or through being a part of a band or orchestra or creative expression and learning about discovery. How do I discover things? Well, that's something that directly affects the success of our workforce, that the arts can instill, we could say teach, but inspire or instill mm-hmm. in these young people. So these soft skills, I think, are a valuable outcome for our economy locally, for our community.
Does it bother you that you have to make what amounts to a utilitarian argument for the arts here, that you can't just make an argument for art for its own sake?
No, I think this is both and.
Okay.
We have to be able to speak both languages. For some people, they want to sit and be captivated and inspired by a performance. And that's great. Other people, they want to know, so what? Tell mm-hmm. me more about what happens because of this program. And we all react to different things in different ways. That's fine. We need to be able to speak both languages, so to speak.
Taryn.
Yeah, but with that, the innovation, there's a big push for STEM education right now. And STEM has been now turned into STEAM to add in the arts. And with that as well, we talk about these soft skills, these critical thinking skills that are great for, the job force and being a holistic citizen. But it does boil down to the person as a whole. And I think if we teach people to enjoy the arts, that is going to come back. And I've seen that in the International Baccalaureate program and how they teach and what skills that they're possessing or kind of trying to teach the kids to learn and take a part of. And so I think we have to do whatever we need to do. If it's STEM, if it's STEAM, if it's just purely the arts, whatever gets the job done, at least in the trenches.
Why is this, though, Drew, such a hard sell? I mean, it seems like it's harder than it should be.
Yeah, no, and I think that's possibly correct. I agree with Michael that it is a conversation that you need to be able to have on both sides of it. The arts lend tremendous value economically, culturally, to a city. But we also need to be looking, as Taryn suggested, at ways that we can bolster student achievement. And to me, that just makes it, yes, it may be utilitarian, but we're taking advantage of the same medium for multiple positive outcomes.
We are talking about the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir's 80th anniversary, which is this year. They were founded in 1937. We're also talking about Music in Our Schools Month. More important, we're talking about the importance of the arts and music in our community and with our young people. If you want to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. My guests are Taryn Cooper. He is an IPS music teacher. Drew Black. He's with the Central Indiana Community Foundation. And Michael Petrie. He's executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. You're not listening to our traditional theme song. You're listening to some beautiful music from the Symphonic Choir. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of thestatehousefile.com, and your host. You're listening to the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. They're providing our bridge music in and out of our segments today. That's what the program is about. We're celebrating the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir's 80th anniversary and talking about Music in Our Schools Month, and really about music, the importance of music and music education in general. My guests are Taryn Cooper. He's an Indianapolis Public Schools music teacher. Drew Black, who is with the Central Indiana Community Foundation. And Michael Petrie, who is executive director of the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir. If you want to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You can find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi, on Twitter at wfyi. Yep. Looks like we had a caller for a moment, but it looks like we have lost her. So I'm going to go to an email. This is from a listener named Andy. And again, our email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Andy writes, "You touched briefly upon reacting to current situations through music. I'm familiar with your, is it Zabor?
Zabor.
Zabor. Piece that you performed at Carnegie Hall. Can you tell me how that came to be and the significance in our current political climate? Thank you. Keep up the great work." I'll throw that one to Michael
first. Great question, Andy. We don't have quite enough time in the program to really dig into all of it, do we? And I'd be interested in knowing, as the arts do, how Andy interprets this, because I think the arts provide the forum to begin the discussion, but don't necessarily provide the answers, just the chance to start the dialogue. So to answer Andy's question more specifically, this piece was commissioned by the Symphonic Choir, but paid for, underwritten, kind of organized by the Symphonic Choir and our sponsors through a citywide commissioning project. There were, I think, just over 60 partners, people from IPS, colleges, universities, churches, mosques, temples, other arts organizations who came together and said, "We'd like to have a new piece of music out there. And we have some ideas about what it may, topics, what it may be about, but let's put our heads together." And ultimately, this body of, as I said, about 60 different institutions and their representatives decided we'd like a piece about the shared human interests, what binds us rather than what divides us. And thus was born Zabor, which is a setting of the Psalms, the text of the Psalms. And of course, that text is shared by the three traditional Abrahamic faiths, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. Different ways of interpreting them, different roles in their faith tradition, certainly. But there is a common bond there. Mm-hmm. And this piece is set in English and in Arabic, as other psalm settings. Bernstein set one in Hebrew, of course, Chichester Psalms. Stravinsky set his in Latin with more the Christian perspective. And so this piece sets the table for a dialogue about peace, about war, about the role of children and families in that. And we can interpret that one way today in 2017. I suspect in 2027 somebody may interpret that a different way, and I hope they do, because that's the role of the arts, of setting that table for a dialogue.
We're talking about music and the arts here on No Limits. If you want to join the conversation, you can do what a listener named Mary Liz has done and give us a call at 866-476-3881. Mary Liz, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
Oh, I was just listening to your program, and it brought to mind that one of my sons, who went either IPS or Washington Township, they used to have in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, I guess, something called a music memory contest, where the kids listened to good symphonic music or other music, and then they would have a questionnaire, and they would identify good music. And then if you got a good score, you got a chart or something, a little something as a reward. But I was with at the symphony with him the other night, and he said that was something that had lingered with him all these years. I think it would be good if they would do that again. And since you had someone from a school there on the program, I thought maybe he could start something like this.
Well, Mary Liz, he is taking notes even as you speak, and I'm going to give him a chance to talk. Thank you very much for calling and sharing your story with us.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye. So, Taryn.
Yes.
Good idea?
Great idea. I'm always up for getting people to sit around and listen to good quality music. And Zoltan Kodály, who we base a lot of our hand signs and solfege, that we attribute that to him today. People in Hungary probably throwing some stones or something because I've heard stories about the solfege in Hungary. But when my kids learn about Zoltan Kodály, he says that everyone has the right to study quality music. Mm-hmm. And I tried to take that practice in my classroom with all the music that I do. And right now, my kids, it's a small group. It's a group of 9, and next year it'll be a group of 17. But they do sit around and they listen to good quality music, and they actually have to analyze the music, and they get to sit exams about that music. So maybe that's a start, and we'll see where that goes from there.
How do we define, how do we define what is good quality music? That's a good way to start a nasty cultural debate, but I'll start with you.
Yeah. Taryn. Yeah. You're absolutely right. What is good quality music? Well, from a teacher aspect, does it have some of the skills that I'm trying to impart to the kids? It could be something about the musical elements. It could be maybe something about social justice or the purpose of music. It could also mean, is it relevant to the kids? That in itself could be considered good music, but can it stand the test of time as well? You know, is it something that gets stuck with, that sticks inside of you, and is something that years on down the road you hear that and it brings you back to that? Mm. And I think good music then can also be aesthetic in that sense as well. And that, to me, if it's good quality music with good quality music elements and there's something that can be taught from it, then that's my definition of good music.
What is the standard, Michael, for the symphonic choir? I mean, I'm assuming that you're not, you know, when you're planning these 3 or 4 years in advance, you're not looking at what's topping the charts at the moment, or, you know.
That's exactly right. I'll tell you what, there's so much music out there.
Mm-hmm.
No one organization can be an expert at all of it or can have all of it in their wheelhouse. We know what our wheelhouse is. We know what we do well. Those are the large, quite honestly, the very big pieces of repertoire that nobody else in this city, few others in this city, I should say, would be programming. And so that helps to drive what we select. That is to say, you need a choir of 180 and you need an orchestra of 100 musicians, which means then also you need an audience of at least 1,400 people to help to make that viable, right? And then you need a hall to seat that large and a hall also to accommodate however many performers, that is 250 or so performers on one stage. It's decisions like that that help to drive what the symphonic choir is programming. Sometimes it is pops music, and you've seen us do a lot of that. Sometimes it's vocal jazz. It's mm-hmm. it's not just Beethoven. But I think it's us being aware of what we do well and the need of the community to hear a certain niche or area of music.
How does one become part of the symphonic choir?
Are you thinking of auditioning, John?
No. I could not hit a note with a high-powered rifle at close range. So no,
Touché.
No, that's not going to happen. But
that's a great question. So the symphonic choir is made up of about 200 singers, slightly north of 200 singers. They re-audition every year. This is competitive.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned earlier, it's a major time commitment. So auditions are held in midsummer, so in the latter days of July. And then also actually mid-season in January. Singers audition. They bring a prepared piece of repertoire. Mm-hmm. They also do some sight reading because we move at a pretty quick clip. So they have to be able to read music at a nice level. And then they do some vocalizing just to understand their voice a little bit and some color that it may bring or any quirks, you know, that folks would want to be aware of. So twice a year if you're thinking about it.
Well, I think we've answered that question. But and how large, how many spots are there available?
So there's no match.
Do you start over every year or is there?
Every singer re-auditions every year. Okay. And the format of that audition varies, certainly. But there's no maximum. We don't have a certain number of sopranos or tenors or basses that we're vying for. Terrence auditioned a number of times, I have to say, so maybe I should ask him.
Yeah, he's sweated through those auditions. Mm-hmm. I don't know why he's still getting nervous, but I think it's just the nature of the beast. They're pretty painless after the fact, but during the fact, it's great. It's well worth the opportunity to sing with the choir.
We have an email from a listener named Kevin, and again, if you want to join the conversation via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Kevin writes, "One point I'd like to make about the value of arts education is that it gives kids a reason to want to go to school. Mm-hmm. Anything that can improve a young person's attitude toward education should be valued highly." Drew, I see you nodding your head, you know, enthusiastically on this one.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, I couldn't agree with him more than that. You know, I get to meet Taryn today. This is the first time we've met, and there's no doubt in my mind that there aren't kids that are coming to Shortridge every day to take part in his classes. We need to do whatever we can to engage these kids. And if that's music education, which appeals to so many, then I fully agree with that.
We've gotten a Facebook message from a listener named Rosanna. And again, if you want to reach out to us via Facebook, you can find us at No Limits WFYI. Rosanna writes, "Just a note to say how much I've enjoyed your Festival of Carols performances. Any insight into what is ahead this year for that performance, Michael?"
A little insider information, I see. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you for the compliment. We really enjoy Festival of Carols, too. That's when we see, actually, to share some information with you, that's when we see our largest group of first-timers come to a performance, as you might imagine. I'll tell you what. This past year, we, of course, hosted Sylvia McNair on the stage. And what a talent and what a joy to work with her at the performances. And broadcast that on television. We're looking to expand our presence on television as well because we know that we can reach a larger audience and start to get the name of the Symphonic Choir and what we're doing spread out beyond just the 1,400 people or so who are in the concert hall. I'll tell you what, Rosanna, we'll be announcing our full season the middle of April, and just check out our Facebook page and you can get the full details about Festival of Carols.
And that would be your full 81st season, then,
yep,
right?
The full 81st season. That's exactly right. So that season begins in September.
It begins in September and all of that. One of the questions that Richard had in his email, he had several, was about future television performances and whether there were attempts, interest in doing more, not just in Indianapolis, but beyond Indianapolis.
Oh, we would love to do more broadcasts. Quite honestly, they're a lot of work, and they don't come free. Mm-hmm. I would love nothing more than for us to have a tradition of every year, or perhaps it's even twice a year. One is our classical concert, like Elijah, that we're doing this weekend. And the other is our holiday concert, Festival of Carols. They should be broadcast. They should be broadcast across the state.
What does it cost to do something like that? And I say, Drew's looking over at you now. Yeah. He anticipates the conversation will move in his direction at some point.
For a radio, just strictly audio, we're looking at about a $15,000 project. Once you move into television, this, of course, is a huge range depending on for-profit versus non-profit broadcast, of course, that's more like a $30,000 to $40,000 price tag for what we're talking about. Richard, I think you said, asked the question. I'd love to see that become more prevalent. That's how we grow the community. That's how we grow the Symphonic Choir and the arts community overall.
Would that be a good investment, Drew, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I guess that's putting me on the spot, right? I have a lot of confidence in Michael and the Symphonic Choir. And, absolutely. I mean, so at CICF, essentially, we invest about $54 million into the community every year. About 10.5 of that goes towards the arts, and just less than 2 of that goes towards music specifically. So organizations that are primarily engaged in music or music education. And we look for opportunities that expand audience bases. We look for opportunities that increase access to those who otherwise may not have it, and for opportunities that are really robust, practiced with intentionality, and really frequent for end users. So, you know, the Symphonic Choir, I think, has checked a number of those boxes over the course of the years.
I've gotten an email from a listener named Alex, and again, if you want to reach out to us via email, you can find us at nolimits@wfyi.org. Alex writes, I was so impressed with the high school group that performed with you at the Festival of Carols. How do you select the groups? Do they practice with the symphonic choir? What do the students think of the experience? I can only imagine it's an amazing opportunity for students. Michael.
This is through our Spotlight Choir initiative, which puts generally high school, but sometimes middle school students in a side-by-side rehearsal and performance track with the symphonic choir. We select those. Eric and our artistic team select those. Representing different geographic areas of the whole metropolitan Indianapolis area. But these are schools that work hard, quite honestly. And what they're doing needs to be amplified, a larger megaphone. More people need to hear about what they're doing. That's been the process.
We have another email from a listener named Alan. Again, the email address is nolimits@wfyi.org. Alan writes, where do you perform, and have you thought about trying to have your own home?
Let's talk, Alan.
Seeing you perhaps at a vacant historic theater, perhaps also have other organizations make that their home and have a shared common space. Is that a vision you think could be supported in Indy? Michael and Drew and Karen, I guess, also.
I'll be brief. We are nomadic. That's exactly right. We have multiple halls that we perform in throughout central Indiana. Would I like to have a slightly more dedicated space? You bet I would. I suspect that's a $150 million proposition or something significant, more than we have in our budget.
And probably more than Drew has in his.
Well,
too.
Yeah. The Symphonic Choir's desire to own their own location is not unique among the arts community. We get a lot of that feedback. One thing Indianapolis does not have, though, is essentially a community space for the arts that could be enjoyed by all. And so that's been something that's been identified over the years as a priority for the city. And we're probably just going to need to figure out, not just us as CICF, but as a community, how we get something like that done. But I think Michael raises a good point. And, you know, we wish there were the number of spaces necessary for all of our performing arts organizations to enjoy, you know, high quality places to both perform and audition.
Taryn, how important would that be for students, do you think?
Oh, I think it would be a great place. On the flip side, I'm going into Shortridge, which has a phenomenal history of music from John Philip Sousa and everything else in between to our own symphony orchestra. And I would say it's about time to bring the Caleb Mills Auditorium back to what it used to be. And if the Symphonic Choir wants to partner with something of that or any other organization, reach out.
I think that will have to be the last word. I'd like to thank my guests, Taryn Cooper, Drew Black, and Michael Petrie for what has been an uplifting conversation. You are listening to the Indianapolis Symphonic Choir as we exit this show. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Cherzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.